Hey y'all, welcome back to Manual Therapy Blog. I'm your host, Matt Thomason. Today in our next interview, we get to speak with Jim Rivard. If you've heard of Jim, it's probably in a couple of ways. One, he's the current sitting president of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. And he's also the author of a three-volume set of books called Scientific Therapeutic Exercise Progressions that he co-authored with Ola Grimsby. So in those two roles, Jim has a lot of insight from the legal aspects of running an academy such as the AAOMPT and the different things that he encounters within that organization as it pertains to manual therapy at large with physical therapists across the country and some of the different battles that they fight with laws changing or trying to protect our profession and what we're doing. So we get to hear a little bit about that today with Jim. Also, we get to hear about his background with the Ola Grimsby Institute, as well as the scientific therapeutic exercise progression in general as a concept and what a little bit about what they teach with that. In addition, Jim is also the co-owner of MTI Physical Therapy in the state of Washington, where he was founder and co-owner and current president of that organization. Whether you're a new clinician or a more seasoned clinician, I think you'll enjoy this interview with Jim because he gives a lot of insight either way on day-to-day practice and things that we can do to improve our practice from a manual therapy standpoint, in addition to just generalized standpoint as well. So tune in. We got a number of ways to listen to this, either on the webpage itself, iTunes, Stitcher, which, by the way, if you haven't checked out any of those, please do so. Diversify yourself. Also, if you haven't had a chance to, please leave a review. Like us on Facebook, Twitter. Follow us, you know, drop your email address in on our website. Any number of ways to stay in touch and get updates when we add new content to the website. So thank you all, as always, for listening. Hope you enjoy this interview as much as all the other ones. I certainly did. And without further ado, here's Jim. All right, everybody. Today we're interviewing Jim Rivard. Jim is a physical therapist currently out of Washington State. And Jim is also the current sitting president of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Jim, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jim, if you don't mind telling us a little bit about your background, you know, where you're from, where you grew up, and then we can get into some other things about your history.
I am a Washington State native, grew up in the big town of Cheney, Washington. Been here all my life except for a little bit of time in San Diego to do some advanced manual therapy training, so true Washington native, currently living in Seattle.
Cool. And how did you first become interested in physical therapy?
Well, I kind of went the route of having the knee surgery in high school and having a little physical therapy at the time, and it didn't really dawn on me at that time that's what I wanted to do. But as I was wandering out of high school, it came back to me as something that might be of interest. So I stumbled into the field in the 80s when it was still a bachelor's and you could push through in 4 years and get to work. So it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Oh, okay. So no other particular influences and kind of how you grew up or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, it was one of those maybe divine intervention that put the idea back in my head, and as I didn't really understand even the entire scope of physical therapy as I went into the, you know, seeking out schools and application process, and the career just opened up more and more as I was actually in PT school of understanding the breadth of it, and it just. It was fortunate for me that I lined up nicely in the orthopedic track, and it's one of the maybe a lucky and best decision I've made.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. I've heard people I've interviewed before say, you know, they just kind of backed up into it or they kind of fell into it. It wasn't wasn't always this particular event that happened in their life, other than, you know, maybe an injury or something that they had to have therapy for. But yeah, it's just kind of similar answer to yourself. So where did you go to college for that?
I went to the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington.
Okay. All right. And then you eventually got into manual therapy and a lot of advanced training. What got you first interested in manual therapy?
Well, you know, I came out of school with, you know, a bachelor's in PT, and I didn't have any real other background in terms of, like, taking in biology or exercise phys background. So I came out of school, as most of us, probably feeling a little under-equipped to deal with the patient caseload. But I was working at a clinic at the time that the owner had taken some manual therapy courses from Stanley Paris and Ola Grimsby. So he had me go out and take those courses within my first year. And it was really exciting for me because I went in thinking I knew something about extremities and knew nothing about the spine, and I went into these manual therapy courses and realized I knew very little about both. So it was very humbling and energizing at the same time to be able to work with some people who really had a in-depth knowledge of both evaluation and treatment approaches in manual therapy. And you know, what really wins you over on anything is to go back and see it change the patient experience and really make a difference in people. So even my novice attempts early were much more successful than what I'd been doing. And then I was just fortunate to be in Seattle at the time that Ola Grimsby started doing residencies in the late 1980s and forced my way into one of those early and just have never gone off that treadmill.
Yeah, tell me the story about how you got into the how you decided to choose OGI or that residency program versus, you know, anything else.
Well, it's kind of funny, you know, Ola and Stanley, you know, worked together back in the 70s, and they have some similar core foundations in manual therapy. So I had taken a Paris course, assuming I knew nothing about the spine, so I was expecting to be overwhelmed in it, and I was. It was a great experience. And then I took an extremity manual therapy course from Ola, and I thought I would know more going into that, and I was just really shaking at the core of how little I understood about biomechanics. And then, you know, he's teaching tissue repair approaches in the 1980s before we had a lot of histology to support it. That's going back to curriculums even from the 60s and 70s out of Norway that really were addressing tissue-based approaches. So I just really got highly motivated by that. It was really exciting to look at the depth of what, you know, rehab exercise can do, as opposed to the type of general exercise I learned in more of a sports background. Mm-hmm. So, when he came presented that some of that information at a kind of an open orthopedic meeting in Seattle, I was just really excited about that sort of curriculum. And then he mentioned that they were going to be starting a residency, and you know, you needed 2 years of training out of school. I was just over a year, so I just kind of went out and begged my way into that program early. And was fortunate to have one of my mentors here in Seattle, Brad Jordan, who has passed away a few years ago, is one of my primary teachers, who really kind of opened up that whole aspect of taking that information into clinical practice. So it was really exciting times. You know, it was, I recall my people at my PT school telling me not to take that in curriculum, and it's PTs wanted to be chiropractors and it's not our profession, and really pushing back on a lot of the things we were doing. And at the time, the APTA was even pushing back against doing residency training, and they adopted the kind of the orthopedic specialty exam as a exam process rather than clinical training and clinical testing. So, you know, to be right in the middle of that, both politically and educationally, it was a really fun, exciting time to sit down with some of the, you know, the teachers that have been out there forever, but also the politics involved and the people both nationally and the state level who were either fighting for or fighting against the trend we're in now.
Yeah, so there's certainly a turbulent time around that period. What would you tell people Or what would your mentors tell people that would be critical and say, you know, that's not what physical therapy is, or, you know, you're just trying to be a different profession? What was the answer to some of that criticism? Do you remember?
Well, I think some of it had to be a little bit more of looking outside of the U.S. a little bit when you think of how much Australia, Norway, and the Scandinavian countries were really ahead of us a bit in manual therapy education, understanding, you know, postgraduate residency kind of education, the need for that. So it was getting people to have a broader look at what they understood physical therapy to be. Our profession in the 80s kind of moved into, a lot of computerized equipment, computerized exercise equipment, and we had a good, we were known for having the best educational system in universities, but the worst clinicians. That was kind of the reputation of the U.S. in the 80s. So that shifted a bit as we got, people from those countries coming in to really show us what's possible. And I think, for most of us, as soon as we become aware of what's possible, we're much more willing to be open and learn. But the hard part is getting people exposed to what they don't know. And rather than feeling threatened, being excited about it and chasing it down. And so you had, you had two camps there, the people who would really take fire with that. And then you had people who were a little more threatened with kind of what they had been doing or their the style of their practice and not really wanting to be challenged like that. But I think today's culture, it's, we're challenged on a, yearly basis in terms of what's coming out in evidence and how it changes what we do. And I think we're much more prone to these, quick shifts, whether it's small or large, and how we practice, but just seemed like a harder stone to move at the time.
Well, since you're involved with the American Academy so heavily, and not just recently, but for a while now, what do you see as some current challenges that as a leadership as a leader in a professional organization that you guys are encountering? Any in particular right now?
Well, we went through just a really great growth phase. The Academy started with 8 fellowship programs, and then we kind of grew slowly, and then all of a sudden we hit a nice stride of jumping up to, hitting close to 30, and now looking at orthopedic residencies, surpassing 150 programs. So just to deal with that volume increase initially was a bit of a challenge because it brought a lot more people to the table, and you saw a lot of different models of how people were delivering that training. So the issues now really revolve around sustainability of some of these programs, because as they move to official accreditation through ABTRI, through the APTA, every program had to kind of up their game a bit to meet those standards and maintain those standards. And then to go through an accreditation process is just expensive. And that happens, for fellowships, that happens, every 3 years from an international basis through IFONT, but then it also happens through ABTRI. So they have to do it through 2 organizations. And it's a lot of paperwork, and it's a lot of time and energy, and it's a lot of people giving up their time, generally at no cost to keep those programs running. And that's the real threat right now, is just the finances of keeping them going. Very few, if any, are really set up to be profitable kind of ventures. They're usually funded through larger organizations or through groups that teach other Con Ed weekend courses to help kind of keep the doors open. But there's such a love and passion for teaching that that group of people is always going to be there keeping these programs open. But now it's there's the students coming out of school wanting to do residency, wanting to do fellowships, so the market's kind of blowing open. And it's I see the challenges for the Academy of, can we get to 100 fellowship programs and really service the volume of PTs out there that really want the training? So, the Academy's really set some larger goals of how we can be sustained for a longer period of time, but see that kind of growth in a way that can continue to support the first program all the way to the 100th if we can get there.
Cool. Well, any other current things that the Academy is working on or either solely or coordinated with any other groups that
well,
is
you,
a pretty big deal right now?
Yeah, I was going to say the exciting thing we're rolling out this year is we have a partnership with PT Foundation. So for the first time, we're we've created our own endowment fund to start promoting manual therapy research. So it's one of those, as I always say, it's hard to say you're evidence-based practicing if you're not really contributing to the evidence. And not all of us have the ability to do research, but we have the ability to help fund it. So we're trying to create an avenue with the foundation where our memberships can, you know, contribute as little as $5 to $10 a month, but add that up to a larger endowment fund and start doing research that matters. We're kind of past the point of trying to say this manual therapy technique is better than that technique. We're trying to show the space that physical therapy and manual therapy fits within the medical models and what we can do as a profession to really change patient outcomes. And those kinds of studies require more money and bigger, you know, a bigger setup to really prove to, you know, insurance companies and the medical profession that the true value that we have. So that was our vision with Foundation, was really creating an avenue to get some larger dollars and get past some of these smaller clinical trials of intervention and really look at the bigger impact of the overall care model. So it's an exciting step for us. You know, the foundation really has been a great organization in how they've worked with us and helped us set up this new venture. But we're looking at trying to raise, you know, $500,000 over 5 years. So it's a lot for us to do with a membership that sits around 2,500 people and growing. But we feel like we've got a good shot at it.
Yeah, and I think I saw a news bulletin that Joe Farrell and his wife made a nice donation. I think it was to that.
Yeah, it was a very, very generous offer of about $10,000 to get us rolling with our funds. So we're excited that, you know, Joe was the first president of the Academy and a true leader in the profession. And, and it's just, you know, great to see him lead in that way and show, for example, what we all should be doing to step up. And obviously we don't have, all of us don't have that ability to write a check that large, but we can do a nice little small auto pay on a monthly basis that really adds up if we can get a lot of people engaged in that process. So that's our hope.
Yeah, and that's nice that it's set up that way where you know, anybody can make a little donation each month. It doesn't have to be a large sum, so thanks for mentioning that to us.
Yeah.
You mentioned previously some mentors that you had early on in your career, and obviously Ole Grimsby being one main one since you did a lot of your training with him. Do you have any other mentors along the way that were significant for you?
Definitely. I mean, you know, I could go on for days on all the people who've influenced me in positive ways, but I think in my foundation, you know, Ola introduced me to the medical exercise therapy group out of Norway, and that was a group of seven clinicians that was really managed by Oddvar Holten as the grandfather of MET.
Mm-hmm.
So out of that group, we had Ronnie Stensness, who came over to the U.S. to teach during my residency and really helped introduce me to that curriculum, which became my passion in manual therapy to really dive into that, teach it, and you know, written textbooks and publishing on that curriculum. So it's really been one of my bigger influences, I think, was having Ronnie come teach us. And then I had a little time with Oddvar Holten. Didn't come to the U.S. a whole lot, and just had one opportunity in Norway to see him. But those to see those guys work in a socialized medicine situation where they would have to see 4 to 5 people an hour and work at such a higher level than I was for exercise, dosage, and prescription. It was very inspiring. So so he would be in that category. I think, you know, I mentioned Brad Jordan as my first manual therapy instructor. He, mm-hmm. he really has been a big influence in Seattle and orthopedics for a long time. And he passed away several years ago, which has been a big loss to the OGI. But not just as a clinician side, but he was just such a great personality. He really knew how to bring people together. So whenever we had international meetings, he was just a great personality to move in and bring people together and solve problems and get things done. So he was a great influence that way.
Cool. Cool.
I'd also throw out Rick Hobush, who's still practicing in Salt Lake City, who is he's actually one of the few MET certified instructors. When he had to go to Norway to get his education, both he and Brad did that as classmates in the 80s. You know, before they did these residencies, you had to actually fly to Australia or Norway to learn something.
Wow.
So those guys made the effort to go in there, and you know, Rick's a guy who, he's the kind of guy you hate. He's a little bit of a photographic memory who can pull out, you know, pull out page numbers and quotes and books that are sitting on a shelf that are still dusty. And amazing guy. So he's got a ton packed in his head, but I think his real gift is really understanding differential diagnosis and all the models people use. But he's just an exceptional diagnostician that way. And so he's been a big influence.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Well,
so that'd be my gang. That'd be the guys that really probably have the biggest impact.
Okay. Yeah, you almost had a perfect segue into my next topic I wanted to talk about, because in addition to being president of the American Academy, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're also the chief academic officer of OGI?
Yeah, I've got two other people helping me, a CEO position and CFO position, kind of running the OGI. I've been involved since about 1993 of teaching courses and residency fellowships with the OGI, and just kind of moved into more academic administration to handle, you know, setting up residency and fellowship accreditation, and then also kind of managing our growth in curriculum. So it's a constant challenge to try to grab new evidence and, you know, have these programs evolve and teach the teachers and all of that. So it's such a labor of love, I guess, where you put in a lot of time and energy to help keep these programs running, because it's one of those, you know, you want to pass on what you were given, and I was given so much by the people who volunteered their time and energy into my clinical training and materials and all of that. So it's just great to turn it around and be able to give back. So I've got a lot of people next to me doing that, and it's, you know, great motivation to be working with them and be working with the OGI.
Okay. Now, one of the other things that I wanted to ask you about is, I know you co-authored a three-volume set of books with Ola Grimsby about the scientific therapeutic exercise progressions. I own them. They're wonderful. I'd like to learn even more about STEP, but can you describe that for us, since you're, you know, so engrossed with that knowledge? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Oh, I'd love to. You know, we started teaching MET, or the medical exercise therapy courses, which was the Norwegian curriculum. You came out of your PT school in Norway, and you did a year or two of manual therapy training, and then you did a year plus of just learning this exercise curriculum, and it required you to have that understanding of, you know, pathology and biomechanics to kind of apply to your exercise curriculum. So we shifted the name to the STEP name in the 90s, just because we did a friendly parting of ways with that group, because we needed to change the curriculum a little bit in terms of how it was delivered in the U.S. So the foundation is still in MET, but we had to talk about exercising on different equipment. We brought in, nutrition and diet and its influence on tissue repair and that type of thing. So it wasn't strictly just their curriculum. And so we had a parting so we could develop it further. Mm-hmm. So we had to give it a new name. So we gave it the STEP name, and building on that curriculum, it really focuses on exercise dosage design and progression. So it's learning to dose exercise as you would a medication. How specific do you need to be to influence tissue repair, influence, you know, development of vascular beds, capillaries for building endurance, and certainly all the motor control aspects of it. So it really had a deeper knowledge base for dealing with pathology and rehab, and these days we have a hard time separating that. PTs want to do athletic training and look at what's generally done in a health club or online and call that rehab, and it's a very different level of expertise that is involved in, you know, true medical rehab. And our profession's kind of drifting from that. We're seeing a lot of clinicians use aids that really don't have training or rely on athletic trainers with their background, and it's not the same information. Understanding how to train for tissue repair, that's the expertise of a, that really requires a physical therapist to understand, you know, pathology and histology and neurophysiology and traumatology and how to apply that clinically. And that's, you know, the fundamentals of what we do every day in the clinic. And then really understanding movement. You know, the APTA is trying to brand us as the movement experts. Mm-hmm. So with that, we should really understand movement and how to influence and how to train. They're not trying to brand us as the delegation experts. We shouldn't be handing this off to untrained staff to be doing one of our primary interventions. If, you know, if we can't do better than the internet or a health club, we're done anyway. But, you know, our profession has a really high skill level. There's so many people out there teaching really advanced levels of motor control training and tissue repair these days that it's it really should be the emphasis to have PTs doing that and getting better at it and really making it the focus and getting away from some of this real old school basic training that physicians are handing out to their patients with, you know, little pieces of paper that really don't represent all we can do.
Yeah. Well, gosh.
But I'm a, go ahead. I was going to say, I'm a little biased, so I'm always pushing hard on the bandwagon for us to get better and better at being able to dose and design exercise so we can, you know, predict the outcome and really influence it.
So along with that, since you're well-versed in that kind of knowledge, if you're approaching a physician or a surgeon, not necessarily to talk about a particular patient or anything, but just to try and help them to understand what you can do or what you know that can help their patients. In your experience, how has that conversation gone in the past? Like, you know, what do you say? What have they said typically? How does that go?
Well, I'm usually asking them what their understanding is in terms of what they want to have happen to their patients and what they perceive we do. Because there's different levels of understanding and different experiences, and I can't argue with a surgeon who's had the experience of his, you know, surgeries getting, you know, damaged in care, whether it's by the patient or the therapist. But we certainly have a lot of great clinical outcome experiences we have that we can share, and it's just getting their perspective, and then from there dissecting it back a little bit to talk about the things we can do early to influence inflammation and pain that don't require, you know, real heavy oxy pain medication type approaches.
Mm-hmm.
The safe ways we can move things early that aren't going to disrupt surgical repair but actually promote healing and avoid some of the downsides of mobilizing. You know, and if they're really interested, I'll get into some of the biomechanical descriptions of why we do things certain ways to influence joint motion or motor control. But I tell you, the thing that has the bigger impact is bringing in some videos. You know, I just had a conversation with an orthopedic surgeon about mobilizing a hip joint, and I used the term arthrokinematics, and he literally said, "I don't know what the hell you're talking about." But it sounds like it's safe. So to come in and actually, you know, I'll show videos of patients doing things that I perceive are very safe early on that I want to, you know, talk about modifying their protocols and creating guidelines in those protocols rather than, you know, a real prescriptive list of exercises and dosages that may not match what that patient needs.
Yeah.
So it's usually that conversation of let's start with a little video to show some of the things we're doing that they may not have seen or appreciate how safe they are, and then talk about really what are the specific things they want to have happen or not happen. And then we talk about how we could do that and meet their needs, but at the same time show them how we can, you know, be a little bit more aggressive in that early intervention that's not just immobilization or isometrics, but really start doing some tissue repair and motor control things much earlier. And we've got research to support that for years. The earlier we get in there, the better the outcome and all the downsides that happen, the longer we wait. So they just need to have faith, and it's building a relationship like anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't really educate people intellectually. You have to really emotionally move them. And I find that, you know, videos and real specific patient discussions has a little bit more of that emotional impact to really win people over, create some rapport, and then from there you work together rather than feel like you're working for them in a way. You should be designing these protocols together. Nothing frustrates me more than physicians writing exercise protocols, because it's fear-based medicine on what you shouldn't do to damage the patient. It's not really an outcome-based approach of identifying specific impairments and how you would then come up with interventions to resolve them. And if you can create a rapport with a physician to have that conversation, then you've got a team, and you've got a career and a business after that as soon as you create those relationships.
Cool. And kind of moving on, one of the things I usually ask people is, since you've been a clinician for so long, and now you're wearing multiple hats, not just as a clinician, what still excites you about going to work every day, whether that's treating patients or working for the academy or OGI, all the different things that you get to do?
Well, I tell you, it always comes back to patient care for me. I've had times away from that, just doing too much teaching and administrative work, and I just find that's a big hole, and that's really what got me into the professions, wanting to help people. And I've had so many people, help develop my clinical skills, that to not use them seems, a little bit sinful. So I love the patient care side, and I love getting in there and really integrating what I'm currently learning modifying my practice. And I'm usually talking to my employees about that. It's like, you can't sit and do the same thing you did 5 years ago even. But, I go back and look 30 years of where I started, and it's just night and day how I practice. So I love that constantly evolving profession, but that constantly evolving clinical skill and critical thinking and all of that. So that's exciting. If I was doing the same thing every day for 30 years, I would have been out of here a long time ago. As our profession gets better and I get better, the patients get better faster, that's pretty exciting and keeps me there.
So what's evolved? Like, what do you do now that you don't do, that you did not do then?
Go back to the dinosaur years of the 80s, it was a lot of modality-driven intervention. I don't have hot packs in my clinics. We have ultrasound units that sit and don't get used, but the bulk of what we do is a manual therapy intervention and real specific exercise approach. So the manual therapy skills get better every year as we get more teachers in and learn to be better at it. And then the exercise continually gets refined as we understand more about motor control and histology. So my exercise choices and designs are very different. I used to have kind of a go-to set of exercises I would match up with different diagnoses, and now it's like I have patients that come in and I match and create exercises that really address what their impairments are, but where they're going functionally as well. So it's just a different focus of my thinking. So even when I enter the room, my brain's in a different headspace to really work with that individual, as opposed to trying to go down a not necessarily protocol approach, but just a basic matching the exercises I know to the patients that are coming in the door. And that just wasn't as rewarding. Now it's a little bit more specific problem solving. And then the other part of that is, I get sent a lot of difficult, cranky, failed patients because of some of the docs I work with. So those add different layers of challenges. You've got whole, biopsychosocial piece these days that's always been a part of that. But it's fun to take on those difficult personalities. But then when you've got some comorbidities and some real challenging, just biomechanical presentations, that's fun for me. And I can say I've got people I work with who will run from those patients and not enjoy that. But you can only do so many ankle sprains before you want to move on and do something more exciting. So
yeah.
So I like the challenge. I like the challenge.
Cool. Okay. So next question. What are some things that you hope younger clinicians either learn from you or take away from their time with you?
Well, my number one piece of information, if you're still in school, is not to marry a classmate.
Wait, did you marry a classmate?
I did not, so I'm
Okay.
not talking to pals. I waited quite a bit longer to get married, but people come out of PT school with a lot of debt these days, and then when you double it up by marrying someone through in your class with the same debt, it makes for a lot of financial struggle. So I'm always sensitive to people coming out of PT school that are struggling to get through residency and fellowship due to cost,
Yeah.
and one of the ways to minimize that is to avoid marrying a classmate. But on a more serious professional side, I just want people to find their passion. And it's not a job if you love it and you're living your passion. And these days you've got a lot of people out there that can help you find that with different types of coursework, and then really diving in taking a residency within your profession or within your specialty. And now those are available. They weren't available 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And so it's a easier road to get into those. And once you really work with a mentor and you really develop your skills, you find that you really love your work a lot more. It can be a frustrating job when you're not succeeding with patients and struggling.
Yeah.
But when you can really, enhance your skills and start to succeed, that really ignites that fire instead of burning you out. So that's usually where I try to send people when they're feeling burnout, is to go find their passion again with improving their skills in an area they're really struggling in.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. Now, another thing that I usually ask everybody is, if your time is done with working in physical therapy or manual physical therapy, and you're retired, or even later in life after that, if there are one or two things that you as an individual are remembered by or remembered for within your profession, what would you hope it would be, and why?
Well, I hope my patients had long forgotten about me and gotten healthy and didn't come back. So I wouldn't want to be up front in their memory. But I think, what I take value in right now is just seeing the people I've taught turn around and teach someone else. And when they can appreciate the value of their instructors the way I've appreciated mine, I'd love to be in that family tree. Just because I've gotten such an appreciation for the people who got me here, and even a better appreciation for my instructors in PT school than I had when I left. So, I just love to be part of that family, rather than, maybe standing out as an individual. It's just nice to be part of that group and that evolution of clinicians.
Okay. All right. And if anything specific comes to mind for this next one, be great to hear. But what is some of the best and or worst advice that you've heard given to other people, or that you've even given out yourself?
Well, marital advice is probably the worst stuff I've been given and the worst advice I've given out. So I'll stay away from that. I've given my 2 cents worth already. Gosh. I think the foundational piece of that kind of sticks back with me is when I remember talking with Ola Grimsby after I finished fellowship and still feeling like I didn't know everything, and was wanting him to tell me when I would know everything and finally feel confident, comfortable. And he made it very clear to me that would be never, and that it's a constant, being that lifelong learner, and it's a constant level of failure and success, and just learning to embrace that and be comfortable with that rather than being frustrated by that. And it was a bit of a turning point for me in appreciating that I'm on a road that's constantly moving in front of me. I'm not trying to reach a destination and then everything stops in terms of my growth.
Yeah.
And I just needed to hear that at that time to kind of helped relieve some of the anxiety I was feeling of trying to be a master clinician after 2 or 3 years, and appreciating that things just take time. You know, anything we do really well at, it took a lot of time and energy and effort. And you got to give yourself that time to get there and not feel like, you know, you need to somehow work harder today to make it happen tomorrow. It's a journey, and enjoy it rather than have an expectation that you're going to get there sooner than it really takes.
Yeah, it's certainly not finishing a fellowship program or residency is certainly not the end. It's only the beginning.
Yeah, it's a good launching point.
Yeah. Okay, since you're in a couple of different leadership roles within the world of manual therapy or physical therapy, if you could challenge other people in your profession to do something, be something, or just something, what would you pick and why?
Well, I think I would challenge just about everyone to step up into the associations around them and support them. And be a part of our profession in that way rather than just a consumer of it. State level, national level, there's just so much opportunity for us to move in and make a difference and get such a better appreciation for what our profession is, what it stands for, how it's gotten here, and where it can go. And I just love seeing people come in early in their career and not waiting until they feel like they, you know, or somehow a senior clinician to move into these roles that aren't always political. Sometimes they're just supportive and real working committees of getting things done at the local level, state level, or national level.
Yeah.
But it really changes people in a real positive way and seems to add a lot of value to how they view their career. So I challenge people that way.
Okay. Now, given your past experience as a clinician and what you're, you know, currently working with, if there were any particular part of the body, you know, area, region, body part, whatever you want to call it, if you could only treat one specific area, however that would be, whether it's exercise or manual therapy, for anybody that walks in your door, what would it be?
Treating one area?
Yeah, so if you see any across the board, people that come into your clinic, it's like, gosh, you know, this is an important area on everybody. You know, it could be anything. You know, what would you pick?
Well, I'd probably have to go with the brain. I'd have to go with their medical literacy level, with their understanding and fear around, you know, their pain or impairment,
mm-hmm.
And then how to influence movement, you know, in terms of the right type of coaching.
Yeah.
You know, you can teach the same thing but use different language and really slow down the performance. So I think they're just, I mean, that's the biggest influence, is to start there and then move it out into the body. So if I was stuck with one spot, that's going to give me the most influence on the most things. So.
Well, that's great, because you pretty much just answered my next question, which was going to be, if you could teach only one thing to a patient, you know, what would it be? So,
yeah,
pretty much answered that one.
Yeah.
Now, one question I need to start asking people like yourself that I get to interview, you know, most everybody is incredibly busy. They either work in their own practice, or they're working in professional organizations, or, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, and you're, like I said before, you have many different hats professionally, but also personally. How do you balance all those different things between professional life and personal life? Because, you know, you're a busy guy, and a lot of the people I interview are very busy. How do you balance all those things out?
Well, I'm not a real believer in kind of this work-life balance sort of concept. I think, you know, our lives are what they are and what we throw in there. I think the fundamental thing for me is trying to be present where I am and focused on what I'm in front of. So when I'm with a patient, I'm not dealing with things related to my personal life And my personal life, I'm not thinking about work, and being able to be very focused and present where I am. And, you know, the further out I think, the more stressed I get when I think of all the things in my to-do list piled on my desk, that just becomes overwhelming and you become less efficient. When you focus on what's in front of you, you can just keep mowing through the next thing, and it doesn't feel like, you know, you're overburdened and overstressed. But, you know, you've had the experience of being at a restaurant with a waiter that has one table and seems like they're stressed out of their mind, and then you see someone has 20 tables and as relaxed as can be.
Mm-hmm.
And usually those people are kind of focused in the moment, what's in front of them, and just getting it done. And that, you know, gets me through. I think that the benefits are having certainly a great life support and personal life to keep me fueled and feeling like, you know, I've got value in life and energized so I can go out and deal with the work things. But, you know, there's, when you look at the work side of it, your career, you can easily separate things that give you energy and things that pull energy out of you.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, if you're going to sit down with a business coach, they're going to draw it up on a sheet of paper and you're going to make that list and set the goal of removing those things that suck energy out and create more space for the things that fill it up. And then you'll never have a sense of being burnt out or not having balance in life.
Oh, perfect. Perfect to hear. Well, Jim, we're pretty much wrapping up here. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you want to bring up or mention?
Oh, gosh. No, other than just creating another plug for the American Academy, if you've got an interest in manual therapy, to come on out and try one of our conferences on for size. It's such a great opportunity to meet people that publish the work and write the books that you're reading from in manual therapy. It's just a wonderful, energetic group of people to be around, to get inspired, and to fill up your battery again. So we've got our conferences in October every year, and easy to find on the web. So look us up and come on down.
Great. And Jim, if you have a place where people could go to find out more about yourself or what you're doing or the OGI or anything, can you direct us to places to go on the web or social media?
Yeah, probably the best place to keep tabs on me would be at olagrimsby.com. Academy is, the amp.org is another great site for manual therapy in general. I will be exiting as president in October, so I'll still be engaged at some other levels with the group. But certainly those are two great resources for what I'm up to.
Okay, perfect. Jim, thanks a ton for your time today. We really appreciate it, and it's great hearing from you. Hopefully get to see you at a conference in the near future here.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you for the opportunity. Hopefully I got something useful for someone out there to learn from my successes and avoid my failures.
Always.
Yeah.
All right, Jim. We really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you again.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.